All right. I don't have my screen this time, but we're just going to buzz through this. And then we want to spend a little bit of time on your notebooks. And this is pretty self-explanatory, but this is really cool. And Dan did a phenomenal job of putting that together. So let me just buzz through this and maybe try to answer some questions that you have. Let me just talk a little bit about your investment options. I don't want to go into great detail on this, but when I say there are investment options, I have in no way included all of your options. But in the course of conversation with people, for most of you, you're going to be talking about retirement, and we're going to talk about retirement in just 1 second. But let me just give you just a little bit of education on this stuff so you understand it. Stocks is basically equity ownership in a company. So it's important just on a very basic level to understand that a stock is an ownership of a company. Bond is letting a company borrow your money. And that may sound like a little bit strange, but when you buy a stock, you're basically buying the company. You're an owner of the company, and you're going to get whatever benefit the company gets, and or whatever value the market thinks that company is worth. But when you buy a bond, it's a substantially different transaction. A bond is not an owner of a company. A bond is a debtor to the company. Okay? So you are actually giving your money to the company, unless you're buying the bond in the secondary market. But for the sake of our conversation, a bond, the reason why it's important to understand when it comes to bonds is there are three very, very particular and important things to know about every bond. Every good bond has what's called a coupon, par, and maturity. It's the three most basic attributes of a bond. A coupon is the interest rate that the bond is going to be paying. Coupon and yield are not the same. Coupon is the attached interest rate. If you think of it this way, when a company issues a bond, they are basically making a commitment that we are going to pay whoever owns this bond this cash flow. Okay? Now, if you happen to buy that bond at a price either less or more than what they issued the bond at, so let's say, for instance, recently we've been buying a lot of bonds. So recently we bought some bonds from, I'm trying to think of a company that you guys would know, GE or Hartford Financial. So let's GE. You guys all know GE. GE issues a bond, and then even within bonds, there are a number of different what we call subordination. So you can be a senior, you can be subordinated. It means that basically the order, the pecking order of if the company should get in trouble, who gets paid first. So the further down the pecking order you go with a bond, the higher the interest rate is, because the more risk you're taking in the event of a problem with the company. But and if a bond, let's say GE issues a bond and they say we're going to have a 6% coupon on a bond that matures in 5 years, and we're going to pay semi-annual payments. What that means is every 6 months, they're going to pay you 3%, okay? They're going to, I'm sorry, let's say for the sake of our example, it's a 6% coupon on let's say you're going to buy a $1,000 bond, okay? At 6%, that means that every year you're going to get how much money? $600. So every 6 months, you're going to get $300. If and then they issue that bond. Now, in the secondary market, I could possibly buy that bond for more or less than $1,000 based on different reasons. But if I buy it for more than $1,000, my yield or my interest rate is going to be less than the coupon. But the coupon itself doesn't change. It is possible to buy bonds with a variable coupon, but the point I'm trying to make to you is that when you're looking at bonds, you're looking for a coupon, the par amount. Par amount is the amount at which they're going to pay you upon maturity, and maturity is the date which they're going to pay that to you. So most bonds, they have a par amount of 100, they're issued at 100, and they mature at a said date. So with a bond, I'm going to give you $1,000. You're going to tell me when I get my $1,000 back, how much you're going to pay me on my $1,000, okay? That's what a bond does. When you buy an equity, you're saying, here's my money, see what you can do with it. There's no guarantees, there's no fixed maturity, There's no time in which I get my money back. There's just no guarantees. And so by definition, there's more risk. And as such, it's traditionally, historically, stocks have outperformed bonds. Definitely not the case recently. So that's stocks and bonds. Bonds, you can buy bonds in multiple things. You can buy them in U.S. Treasuries. A municipal bond is a bond that's issued by a municipality. So it's a city or a state, and they have tax advantages to them. Treasury bonds are typically state tax-free and federally taxable. So, anyways, and then there's corporate bonds. Mutual funds. A lot of times people think that they think stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. When you think of a mutual fund is nothing more than a holding vehicle. A mutual fund in and of itself is not a stock or a bond. A mutual fund is just that. It's a fund. It's a holding vehicle that can own within it stocks or bonds or both. Okay? So don't be confused. A mutual fund is not a descriptive characteristic of an investment. It's the vehicle with which the investments are being held. So I can own stocks by themselves, or I can own stocks inside of a mutual fund. And when I buy that mutual fund, I'm usually buying it in one of two ways. I'm either buying it as an index, meaning that it's a predetermined portfolio of stocks that has been derived by either a research company or by some quantitative model or whatnot. Or if I buy a mutual fund, I am going to pay somebody to basically buy and sell stocks inside of that fund, and then I'm going to get a price for that fund at the end of each day. So that's a mutual fund. The reason I bring this up, and you'll notice that I did not put it on here, because this comes up a lot in our industry, is you ever heard of a variable annuity? Anybody heard of variable annuities? You probably have heard of variable annuities, particularly if you're on the older side. A variable annuity is an insurance product. It is not an investment product. It's an insurance product that they're trying to make into an investment product, and they are frustrating the living daylights out of people because it's kind of like an El Camino. You get none of the benefits of a truck, and you get none of the benefits of a car, so why'd you buy it? That's kind of, those of you that are ranchero, if you don't know what an El Camino is. But this is what we tell people. A variable annuity is like an El Camino. It doesn't actually accomplish either thing very well. So we tend to tell you, just stay away from those things for the most part. There are the rare exceptions when they make sense, but for the most part, they're that. And then lastly, I put on here ETF, which is an exchange-traded fund. In the last 5 or 6 years, there's been an explosion of these in the industry. And basically what an ETF is it's a mutual fund that trades like a stock, essentially, so that it's priced each and every day, all throughout the day, every 3 to 5 seconds. So at our firm, we spend most of our time investing. And an ETF is not a type of investment. It is a type of holding vehicle for investments. Okay, so the ETF in and of itself is neither a stock nor a bond. It just might be comprised of stocks and or bonds. Okay, so in our line of work, we deal primarily in stocks and bonds, and we deal with them oftentimes in the vehicle of an ETF, and then we also deal with all kinds of different private equity, venture capital, hedge funds, things like that. So that's kind of the world that we live in. This is our background. I will tell you this, it's kind of funny, but the investment business, it's like its own world. If you've been watching the news, or if anybody happens to run across that lunatic Jim Cramer, if you're going through your TV and he's mad money and he's totally nuts, he's actually very intelligent, but he is verifiably nuts. It's a whole language. It's a whole world. And I have to be honest with you, most people in the investment business are so disconnected with reality. I mean, all you have to do is read the news. You know, you see these guys buying $85,000 rugs while their company stock goes to 50 cents. You know, it's by my own admission, it's one of the reasons why I left the investment bank I was working for. The industry is just wacko. It's just full of really smart people who are just really greedy, and they make way more money than they should. But they're capitalists, and so they figure, hey, why not try it? There's a few really actually good Christian people in there, but not most of them. So that's kind of the investments in markets. Now, what I wanted to do was show you a little bit about how to think through this when it comes to investing, and what what the order of priority is, because for most of you, the primary vehicle, the primary basket, if you will, the primary reason or source for your savings is going to be for your retirement. The days of pensions, what they used to call defined benefit plans, which meant that if you worked for a company all your life, they would just basically pay you a retirement. Those days are, for the most part, gone. They now call it a defined contribution, which means that you're basically saving for your own retirement. That transition happened kind of in the late 80s and the early 90s, and so that companies were no longer basically held responsible to pay for the retirement of their employees. So I often get asked the question, and this is what I wanted to bring up with you guys. I often get asked the question, what's the best retirement vehicle for me? Which obviously is a case-by-case basis. But let me just show you, in terms of importance and priority, how we feel if you've got the choices, this is the order of priority of where you need to be saving your money. Okay? First one would be is if you work at a company or you're at a if and when you get into a church and they haven't already, or if they have already set up a 403B. 403B is the same as a 401K. It's just for a nonprofit, for a 501C3, all these acronyms. But a 403B is just simply a retirement vehicle for nonprofits. So most, and not most, but oftentimes a church, if they're going to create a retirement account for their staff, will just simply file what's called the IRS 403B, which is a way for them to basically save money on a tax-deferred basis. And it also goes in pre-tax. Okay? If those of you that have worked for a company that had a 401K, you know that the money goes in pre-tax and it grows tax-deferred. So you say, no, so why is this the order of priority? If you have the choice, if you had choices 1 through 5, and not everybody has choice number 1, but if you've got, or number 2, but if you've got choice number 1, if you work at a company or at the church that you're at, or as you as leadership decide that you want to do that, if you have a retirement vehicle where there's any matching whatsoever, do as much as you can. It is free money. Okay? If you work at a company and they are matching you, whether it's up to 6% or up to 8%, you absolutely should be doing everything you can to be doing that. Okay? Matching means that for every dollar you put into that, which is pre-tax money, which means you're not getting taxed on it, okay? You're not writing it off like you would maybe in an IRA, but you're not even getting taxed on it. It comes out of your paycheck before it gets to you. That money, if you put a dollar in, the company or the organization has said, we will put set amount to join that. So for every dollar we put in, we'll put a dollar, or we'll put 50 cents, or we'll put a dime, or up to a certain amount. Whatever the matrix is, if you are in an organization that has a matching program, you are nuts not to do that. Absolutely do that. Having said that, the next best option, and this is our view, okay? Maybe arguably, but it's our view. The next best option is what's called the Roth IRA. This is an IRA that was introduced in the last couple of years. The reason why we say this is because if you invest in a 401k or a 403b, your money goes in pre-tax, it grows without being taxed, but when it comes out, it's taxed as ordinary income, okay? Which isn't necessarily bad, because you typically, for most people, their tax bracket at retirement is less than it is today. But the reason we like the Roth IRA so much is the Roth IRA allows you to put money in. It's after-tax money, so it's money that you've already paid tax on. It grows tax-deferred, and it comes out tax-free. Okay? And your heirs don't have to take it out of there. Okay? I don't want to get too complicated on how IRAs work, but basically is with a Roth IRA, you could be young. I mean, really young, like me. That was supposed to be a joke. Okay? You could be really young. I could be putting money in there that could be in there for 20, 30 years growing. So I could put $1,000 in there, and it could be worth, you know, I'm really good at this, and it's worth $10,000. All $10,000 comes out tax-free. I don't pay any tax on that whatsoever. You also don't have mandatory distributions and a lot of other things that the other IRAs have. So if you can do it. Now, there are some income limitations which go away, actually, in 2010. but you need to consult the tax guy on that. But if you can, after you've matched, after you've done, so what I would typically say is you want to put money into a 401k, 403b until they've stopped matching. Once, in other words, you've maxed out to the amount that they'll match, I then recommend going and starting in Roth IRA. Okay? Don't keep putting into that. Now, you can't put an unlimited amount into a Roth IRA. It's $4,000 per person. But the point is I think this vehicle is so flexible and so advantageous for most everybody out there that the minute you get a chance, go to the Roth. Next choice would be if you've got a 401k that does not match. So if you work at a company or a ministry that does not match at all, I actually recommend for most people to do a Roth before you do a 401k. Just because the tax-deferred nature and the tax-free distribution is so valuable. Okay? Now, you can actually, plus, it also allows you that inside of an IRA, a Roth IRA or a regular IRA, you've got a lot more choices for investment. You've got a lot more choices to on how to invest that money. So you've got Roth, regular 401k, then you've got your IRA and your spousal IRA. So typically, you can only invest in an IRA if you've got earned income. But if you're married, you can actually do one for your spouse. It's slightly less than the $4,000. And then lastly, you've got a standard account. So that's just kind of some helpful information, I hope, in terms of that. Yeah.
Can you just speak to the early withdrawal penalties and precautions there, but it's not liquid money that you can get out in
your... Yeah, no, it's a good point. Retirement accounts have some limitations to them. The government says, we'll let you let this money grow tax-deferred. We'll give you some tax incentives for putting it in there. We'll maybe give you some tax incentives for taking it out based on the, which one of those vehicles you're using. But the government also says that once money goes into what's called a retirement vehicle, which is 401k, 403b, IRA, or an insurance product, okay, variable annuity, you cannot take money out of that without being penalized until you're 59 and a half. Okay? You're there. So, once the money goes in there, it's there. Now, can you get access to the money? You can get access to the money, but typically, almost always, there are a few exceptions for first-time home buyers. So, there are some caveats to that that you need to talk to your accountant with. But for the most part, if you put money into a retirement vehicle and then you decide that you want to get that money out, okay? And unfortunately, I've seen quite a few people do this where they're putting money into a 401k and then they're tapping their 401k to invest their money with some, you know, I don't know, Everglades Park or something. I don't know. But you're going to pay a pretty hefty penalty on that. You're going to pay typically 10% penalty for taking it out before 59 and a half, and you're going to pay ordinary income. So if your income bracket is 20-25%, you're going to basically lose 35-40% of that money for taking it out. The reason why we caution you with that is you don't want to be putting money in those things that you think you may need to get out. And that is long-term, sock it away, don't look at it again money. Yeah. Yeah, no. If the money stays within the account, you can basically, if you have an IRA or a Roth IRA and you've got a normal joint account, you can actually do the same things. You just can't take money out of that account and put it in this account. So the money, let's say you own GE stock and you buy it at 20, you sell it at 23, the $23 just stays in the account. But as long as you're not taking that money out into your personal thing. Now, I will say this. A Roth IRA, if you put money into a Roth IRA, it's after-tax money, right? You actually can access that money, but it has to be there 5 years. So I guess what we're trying to tell you is don't put money into retirement accounts if you think you need the money. Okay, it's not worth it. That being said, there are a few slight things. Yeah. Yes. Certain medical expenses, first-time purchases, education needs, there are certain needs. I guess the bigger issue is don't put it in there if you think you're going to need it. If you've got a retirement account and you have a possible need for that money, consult an accountant before you do that, because there may be opportunities for you to get to that money without paying penalty. But you will pay tax. Okay? So there are a few ways to get to that money without paying penalty, but you need to check. But you'll always pay tax on it.
You'll pay tax and penalty based on the return on investment?
Right. On the amount above which you put in there. Right. Well, no. You'll pay penalty if you put $2,000 in an IRA and next year you take it out, you'll pay 10% on the $2,000. Plus tax on the amount above $2,000 on your earnings. It's kind of complicated, but the basic premise is if you're going to need it, don't use it. Don't put it in there. Okay? You know, you guys can read this. I don't want to kind of belabor the point on this. This is more implementation stuff. It's a lot of fancy words for just have a plan, because you can lose money really fast in the stock market.
Sorry, hold a
question. It's okay.
So if someone's got debt, do you recommend knocking down the debt before they begin investing? I had a couple of kids.
Yeah, you know, that's his question is do you what do you recommend in terms of investing versus knocking down debt? Or another question that sometimes comes up is if I have got savings and I owe and I've got credit card debt, should I take money out of savings to pay it off, particularly if my credit card is earning or charging me substantially more than what I'm earning? The simple answer is you never want to pay interest on if you've got money to pay it off. The more difficult answer is how disciplined are you? Because if you're going to pay it off but not replenish your savings, you need to deal with that. But to answer your question in terms of debt, goes back to kind of some of the earlier questions about situations. I think it's a situation by situation case. How do they get into that debt? What was the cause for it? Is there a pattern there? In general, I don't think it makes sense to pay penalties to pay down debt unless the debt service is so oppressive that you may need to do that. Okay? So, okay. That's it. That's all I have for that stuff. So let me just quickly go over this notebook with you guys, and then we'll take some questions. Did you want to talk about this, Dan? Okay. Hey, just very quickly, this is a really neat thing that Dan did for you guys, and I really hope you guys use this. After 9/11, I was traveling quite a bit at the time. I was living in Chicago. I remember right where I was when I saw the towers collapsing. And it suddenly dawned on me that I was totally irresponsible as a husband. Not that I wasn't providing for my family with insurance and all the different things. What I realized, if something happened to me, my wife wouldn't know where to go. I mean, there's a lot of complexity to the daily things in our life. And in our family, I've made the choice to completely relieve my wife from any of the burden of the details. So car insurance policies and titles and credit cards and bills and all those things, I had just always done. It's easy for me. I'm a quickened guy. But I realized that would become extremely emotionally cumbersome for her. The other thing that drove me crazy is I kept getting asked by various situations what my kids' Social Security numbers are. And I never knew. I mean, I always had to go back and find them. So anyways, what I did was I created a life notebook. So Dan's kind of replicated that. What I highly, highly recommend, this is a great thing to do for yourself, is just creating a notebook that holds all of the documentation that you or somebody would need in the case of your untimely death. It's just a kindness thing. So what we do in here, and we've kind of got it on here, key documents. What I've done in my booklet that I keep, I've got two of them. I actually make one, and then I make copies, and I've got it in a safe place. But on the front page, I have listed on ours all of our kids, all of their Social Security numbers, all of their birth dates. I know I should remember that, but it's still helpful for me. Years. I know the dates. It's the years that I always get mixed up on. And then I've got all of our credit card numbers and the 800 number to call, you know, that's on the back of it. That's also helpful if you ever lose your wallet, because you've got everything right there. So I've got all my account numbers. I've got all the telephone numbers. I've got all my savings accounts, all of my any financial account that I have, my retirement accounts, my brokerage accounts, my credit card accounts, everything is right there on one page. It's extremely helpful, and I use it all the time, all the time. And then what I keep in here, as you can see, if you open up that first page, I keep in one section, and Dan's done this for me. Now, what I've done in mine is I brought to you to show you, is instead of three-hole punching each paper that I get, I just keep this. I slide in my policy. So, for instance, the first section is key documents. Those don't change. So I've got all my kids' birth certificates. I've got my marriage license, just to remind my wife that she can't go anywhere. I've got passports, social security cards, and so forth. I actually, like Dan put here, I actually put passwords in there. And then any title documents. So if you own title outright to a vehicle, if you own title outright to, you know, your boat, you know, motorcycle or whatever would have a state title to it, I keep in there. And it's just so nice to have. It's the kind of stuff that you know you've got in a file somewhere, but it's not very easily accessible. So any other asset title that I would have, I have in there. Okay. The second section is banking. So bank account information, credit card, and loans. I don't necessarily go in there and put all my monthly statements. That's not what I do. What I do have is I have a page in there that lists the account numbers, the phone numbers, and the information that's needed for that. Now, because I do most all my banking online and through Quicken, and my wife would have a nightmare trying to figure out how to get in there. Because keep in mind that if you have an untimely death, you got to get a death certificate. I can tell you from experience with some of our clients, it's a nightmare. If you don't have access to the information, getting it, even if it's your own spouse, is just a pain. On top of that, you're grieving, so it's very disappointing. But I keep major bank accounts, credit card information, loans, mortgages. Dan's got it all in here. And I keep that in a section, okay? And then you can just look down. I've got investments as one section. And then number four, I've got asset protection. That's probably the one that I frequent the most, because that's the one that's changing on a regular basis, right? You get your policy statements on an annual basis. And so what I do is I keep everything in there. And it's just so nice to have all that. And then I also have, like he says here, asset transfer. So I've got wills, living wills, and trusts. I'm going to say something about that in a second. What the notebook does is it allows you to have in one little simple place all the pertinent information that you need, not only for miscellaneous stuff if you're applying for a mortgage and you need this, that, and the other. I also keep, and we didn't put it in here, but you could do it, is I keep my last 2 years' tax returns in mind, so that I've got in one fell swoop, I basically have all the data that I would need to answer any questions, or that my wife would need to answer any questions on information that at this point she doesn't have any interest in knowing. She just doesn't have any interest in the detailed information of that stuff. And we've got on here asset transfer, wills, living wills, and trust. Let me just say this. A lot of people think, well, I don't have a lot of money, so I don't need to do a living trust. That may or may not be true, but having a will is very, very important. If you don't have a will, no matter what the size of your estate is, and an estate is nothing more than the total net worth value of what you own, and it typically doesn't happen, but even if it's just one person, if you don't have a will, it has to go to what's called intestate. It has to actually go to court. It's just a pain in the neck. All it takes is very simply a will. Quite honestly, the best way to do it, if you don't have a will, is you got to sit down with your spouse, is go to LegalZoom.com, and for $35 or whatever it is, you can fill out the questions. It's a full binding legal document. It will be absolutely proper and appropriate in the court of law, and it's the best way to do it. You can actually do a living trust there too, but at the very least, you need to have a will, specifically if you've got family, so you can deal with medical power of attorney. You can also deal with who's going to take over, watch the kids, protect the kids, who's going to be in charge of providing? Let's say, for instance, you've got life insurance. You die. All of a sudden, there's a big chunk of money. Who's going to be in charge of investing that money? Who's going to be your trustee? All those things. You need to have that stuff done. Okay? So this could be actually a fun project. I mean, you'll be surprised. You'll actually feel really a huge sense of accomplishment when you get this done. It really is. It's kind of a silly thing, but I love it. I keep it in my desk, and I've got a copy of all of the documents in a safe place. It's just so nice. There's nothing worse than having those people ask you, well, what's your kid's social security number, or what's this account number, and to know that I've got it is really, really helpful. And this is a really nice notebook. So that's it. Did you want to cover a little bit of tax stuff?
Because I think if there was an untimely death, I have so many passwords into all the accounts and banking, and my wife, you know, they're my passwords. So, and she may know them or have written them on a piece of paper, and they're in some place in the office. But again, when you're grieving, it's really hard to think clearly. So again, it's just going back to being responsible for each other, so that it happens either way. You have access to all this stuff. Throw that in a safe. It's locked down. And you can do like Mark said. You can take it to another location, drop it off at a friend's house, and if your house burnt down, a parent or sibling that could hold it for you, and they're safe. That kind of thing. But these things are like, go out to Costco tomorrow afternoon, get a hot dog. It's $1.50. You get a Coke, buy a safe, be done with it. You know?
Yeah.
So it's just a
tool.
This
is one
for
of the.
You.
My wife had more appreciation for me doing this than a lot of things I've done for her. She was extremely thankful for this. Not that she was excited about me possibly dying, but if I did, it was just nice to know that I'd thought ahead enough to know that I was communicating my care for her ahead of time.
Right. And when you get into it, when you start having investments one day, if you're young, but when you start, you get all these policy changes all the times and updates and profiles, and that's why you use the slider sheets. You just keep sliding them in and out. So,
right.
On the taxes. It's more of a resource that I'd recommend. There's a ministry in Los Angeles. They're actually tied to the ministry out there, but they're independent. They're a third party. It's called Stewardship Services Foundation. I will give you their business card. They, as a ministry, will do your taxes for free if you're in the ministry. That's they're supported by a bunch of businessmen who fund this ministry, and they understand that all the intricacies of being dual status in the pastorate, ordination, licensing, they understand all that. They have, you can go to their website. Mark's printed off their little questionnaire tools to help you. So it's really important that you take advantage of that. It's a huge saving. So for say if you're using Mark's example, you make $50,000 a year as a pastor, and your housing, the total package of your housing and expenses is 25, then you're only going to pay taxes on the 25 to the 50. But you got to keep really good records. And so he teaches you how to do that. This is a ministry that you don't have to give them a dollar. I mean, they are funded to serve pastors. They understand all the idiosyncrasies. Let them do it for you. Take that burden off yourselves. Get it in a timely way. Don't wait till the day before. That's frustrating any accountant. But you can download their prospectus. They tell you things. They send out bulletins all the time saying, hey, be cautious of this. But the way you simply do taxes, make it easy. Go to Home Goods, buy three matching boxes. So you have your housing receipts, your ministry receipts, and all of your bills, et cetera. That's how I do it. We simply have three boxes. So every time I come home all through the year, because you don't want to start throwing these receipts all over the house, because you've got to document if you are audited. My wife buys Windex or goes to Walmart, she knows it goes into that housing. All of that's tax deductible. It's tax free. But you've got a document. If we buy a vacuum, we buy a couch, everything when you're a pastor. So you've really got to start thinking clearly. They'll teach you how to do that. But if you create three boxes, put them on the shelf, the boxes have no lids on them. I just walk in when I get home that evening, I've gone to Target or Costco and started, I drop it in there. Then once a year, we just sit down. It takes us about 2 or 3 hours. We go through all those receipts. We circle what is, that way we always document. So all that stuff's tax-free. Everything you do in your house, you buy a lawnmower, it's part of that housing allowance that the government says as a pastor you get. So this is why you
it's
want
huge,
to do this.
But just so you understand, most leadership in churches in America don't understand the tax laws as it pertains to pastors.
Right.
And it's huge. I mean, they'll do, I think, almost 700 to 800 returns, and And there's still hundreds, if not thousands, of pastors that don't take advantage of this. It's huge. I mean, it's crazy not to do it. And if you're not even sure if you qualify for it, call them. I mean, these guys are great. I've known Jim Rickard. I went to college with his son. They are so efficient. It's unbelievable. Stewardship Services, it's ssfoundation.net is their website.
Yeah, we created that. It's on that little card you have. But, I mean, that's what they do. But you just have to know certain things. Once a year, you declare to your leadership what you anticipate spending on housing. So if you anticipate spending $50,000, then $50,000. I always say, you know, go beyond what you think. If you do all your bills and it adds up to $50,000, then go $55,000 or $60,000. You can't go back and change it. In other words, if you spent $70,000, you had to go out and buy a bunch of things for the house you were not anticipating doing. You can't go back and add the $70,000. You only go to what you declared up front. You can change that declaration as the year goes, but you can't retro that declaration. And so just go over it. All that means is if you declare $50,000 and you only spend $30,000, you're just going to pay tax on the difference. It doesn't mean anything. You just need to be aware. I don't want to float this too high because I'm actually going to may owe the government at the end of the game. But those are the kind of just simple things you need to know about. I can assist you, and I'm here. You know, they're going back to California, but I'm here all the time. You can come to my office if you're struggling with this kind of stuff. But keep it very simple. Make it very easy access. Keep everything, receipts. Take someone out to the church for a meal that you're not going to get reimbursed by your church for. That goes in the ministry box. You buy books. That goes in the ministry box. You know, and you.
It basically allows you to act as almost like a self-employed business person,
right?
But you're in the ministry, and it's a great way to do it.
Yes, sir.
Question: I know that the IRS is on the accounting on the receipt section. Mm-hmm. They're changing almost every 6 months on certain things. You know, between secondary and primary receipts. In other words, like the motels and things like that. Mm-hmm. If, let's say, something happens to the primary receipt, they don't accept the secondary coming from your credit card account
right, as
being paid. If they change those rules, do they keep you updated to that?
Yeah, they'll keep you updated on anything major. You know, the government's changing all the time, and you can only do so much. I've been doing this for, you know, 23 years, my taxes like this, and it can get very complex. I make it very simple. You can get 3 shoe boxes. I have 3 extra shoe boxes in my house. I'll give you, and you just set them up, and you write on there those receipts and drop them in there and do it. When they don't want to see all your receipts, they're going to do is give you a questionnaire at the end of the year. You're going to fill it out based on your information.
But you need to retain those for 3 years.
3 years, and then you jettison them. We rotate.
I get audited almost every year.
Wow, lucky you. That's great.
Yeah. No, the reason being,
congratulations.
I was in construction.
Okay.
Was the food good in prison? Or
yeah.
Not good?
No,
wow.
I was a millwright, and I had motel expenses, mileage, and so every time, you know, they were saying, yeah. I had to even keep my oil receipts for my truck to prove the mileage.
I keep every receipt, and we just, because you look at it any of the year, it's like 3 little shoe boxes in your apartment. And if you don't use them, they don't count for anything. You just chuck it all away at the end of the year. But if you need to go back, just you're returning something. We're just meticulous about that. It's real simple. And we don't even look at it. We just walk by Walmart, chuck it in the box, chuck it in the box, chuck it in the box, chuck it in the box. And then we do all online banking. I do just like bills. We do kind of our bills like that. And then your ministry receipts and your housing. Basically, ministry and housing is what
you're going to do. Just be careful when your mother-in-law comes by to help clean up. You're like, no, not that box.
But like bills are your medical. Medical is very important. You got to document your medical. So that's always in the bills, like medical, eyeglasses, contacts, solution. I mean, there's just – it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
Yes?
One way to eliminate potential audits is to have a reimbursement account set up at the church. Most churches have it. So they'll actually reimburse you on a monthly basis so you don't have to deduct it from your
own package. Right. What I've always had more than I feel like is justified me turning into the church. You know, in other words, if a missionary comes to town and I'm pastoring and I want to go out and take him to dinner and bless him, and I'll write that as a ministry expense. I may not turn that into the church because that's coming from us, but I'll, you know, so we do. It gets a little bit of a conscience issue sometimes, but you know, you have to kind of work through that. But that's just to help.
Dan's known me for 30 years. He witnesses to me every time we go to dinner.
Right.
So he can write it off.
Last night, he got the gospel. Absolutely.
It's like, okay, Dan, do your prayer.
Yeah. As long as you pray over your meal, it's ministry. Trust me. There's that, and there's all the whole perspective or spectrum there. But anyway, the bottom line is you don't have to know a lot about it. Just call them. just call Jim, say you know me, Mark, whatever, and they're going to do this as a ministry for you. So don't pay an accountant, and they specialize only in pastors and ministry missionaries, so they know the gig. So, and this is a little bit complicated. So that's it on the tax part of it. Everybody have a card? Any questions on that? All right, let's do some question and answer. I just want to make a couple statements that I wrote down as I was listening to Mark, just that I think would help you. One is, when you do the credit report, that's one of the largest scams in America. You go to a credit report site, and you type in all your information, give them your Social Security number, and it's a shell, and it's identity theft. So make sure that you follow. The government puts out a list of reputable places to check your credit report. Mm-hmm. And if you've had your identity stolen, I've had it twice, it's not fun. So make sure that you're always checking that on the credit report. Giving, you need to be, if you're in the ministry, you need to be giving now, and you need to be super generous. And learn that now. You want to practice now in seminary things that you're going to expect your people to do in the future. Don't expect them to do it when you weren't doing it. You understand? It's very important, Mark, hit that, but I just want to emphasize the importance of you being generous now, and you'll learn to be generous with people, with your staff, as you hire staff. You'll care for them. You're not looking for slave labor. You want to care for them, make ministry a joy. They don't have to be distracted. So learn to be generous. There's nothing worse than a stingy preacher. It's contrary to everything the New Testament calls us to be and to do. Okay? So I just want to emphasize that as well. Mark, why don't you start the Q&A, and we'll kind of come up here with mics. Bob, you want to come up as well? There's some mics up here. Start the Q&A by explaining. These guys are students and gals. Students, debt. How much debt? Is there good debt with student loans? I mean, if I'm a medical doctor, $200,000 because of my potential net worth in the future, I can handle $200,000 of debt. But as a pastor, your sweet spot is going to be between 45 and 85 salary. That's it. Now, of the 1% or 2% of you that might become a megachurch pastor, you may hit 150 and max out salary-wise. Those are your ranges, so... And depending on, it's some geographical. In Los Angeles, we had to pay more because your condo was $800,000. So that's always a challenge. But your sweet spot, in, for example, Louisville Church of 1500 to 1600 here, pastors making about 82.5. That's how much they're making, 82,500. So you're not making big bucks. That's the point. That's why we have to be good stewards. That's why we want to do this and serve you. So answer the question in your mind, because you have some subtle principles there. But how far do they go in student debt? $400,000, PhD, triple PhD, move the family to Scotland, just bury themselves, and they're going to go back. And you're going to make, as a PhD, you're going to make about $45,000. That's high end.
Yeah.
Unless you're writing 20 to 30 books.
I think that all debt needs to be pursued, or at least perceived, on a very practical level. And I was telling Dan earlier, I always try to attach a very practical view of debt. So let's take student debt, for instance. I think student debt is normal. I think it's appropriate. Student debt is an investment, is a capital investment in a resource that can generate cash flow. So I think it makes a lot of sense. I was telling Dan, one of the simple formulas that I would use, it would be similar to the one that I use for my motivation in developing my life insurance policy. And that is this. If I was pursuing a vocation that required me to be educated at a graduate level, which is what we're talking about, and is going to incur debt, I think I would probably try to do everything I could to get myself positioned to have a debt load that could be paid off before my first child enters kindergarten. You're like, what is that? Why would you think that way? Because kids are expensive. So... let's say you're 23, and as you get married, or maybe you're not married, but you're kind of thinking in your mind, we want to be married, I'd like to be in ministry, we'll have some kids, 5 years, I'm 3 years away from that, 8 years. Okay, how much do I think I can practically pay off within 8 years? Okay, because I will tell you this, entering marriage or beginning marriage with heavy debt loads is extremely difficult. And the reason why it's difficult is because when pregnancy occurs, which rarely happens as we plan it, okay, it puts a very, very heavy stress load on the family financially, because very few of you are preparing yourself, even though you should, to live off of one income exclusively. Okay, this was a big issue in LA because it's very difficult, and quite frankly, it's one of the big issues that I think is tackling, if you will, the church, is the presupposition of our generation of women don't work, they stay home with the kids, is now not a foregone conclusion with young couples anymore, and it's one that we've had to deal with on a pretty wide scale. But on a practical basis, I don't want to take on so much debt that as I'm getting into my heavy obligation years of kids and school and all those things, my wife not working, I don't want that to be ongoing. So my practical advice would be is don't take on any more debt, even if it means going and getting all these, you know, terminal degrees and so forth. The fact of the matter is God can use you just fine with a little bit of Greek and Hebrew. You don't need to have, you know, Byzantine cultural artifact.
We'll strike that for the record. But
history.
You're a seminary.
So anyways, I just think that as a general rule is a healthy way to look at it. I don't think it's wrong, but I don't think you can justify extreme heavy loads of debt for your personal education needs when it's going to create most likely some heartache in the future.
One of the things we did when we were transitioning to start plotting to have a family was we, in the ministry, we went to one. In other words, Jane kept working. We had no children, but we planned and plotted. We just took her salary and we put it in the bank. Never saw it, just went direct deposit to a separate account. And we learned to live on my income. So we adjusted our living. We downsized to a one-bedroom apartment. Just, in other words, what's it going to feel like to live on one income? Because we had the conviction that Jane was not going to work while we had young children in the home. We just felt like that was a Titus II issue for us. And we do promote that culture here, you know, at Southern Seminary. I mean, I can think of Grace Church in our fellowship group of a couple hundred. I can't think of a couple that worked outside the home, the wife with young kids at home. There may be some now as the pressure's on with all the...
It's very few, but...
Yeah, I mean, in a church of 7,000, we had... I mean, I couldn't count them on one hand because it was just kind of the DNA of that local church. But there's some joy in that the moms are, you know, able to stay home because people are living within their means. But you've got to make some choices and begin to establish those habits, those disciplines are in the game. So,
yeah.
Dave?
Mark, how do you adjust that counsel to someone who's 30, who has a couple kids, and is now coming to the seminary and thinking about taking out a loan to supplement their needs?
No, that's a very, very appropriate question, because I we've got firsthand experience with that being done the right way and the wrong way. I don't want to step on any toes. I think you need to be extremely careful to put a family through extreme angst and unrealistic life for my personal educational needs. And I actually think this, and I hope this doesn't go far and wide, I think we need to seriously consider our call when it causes extreme levels of sacrifice for a family that didn't know that going into the life marriage. And I know that it's easy for us to slap it with a super spiritual label and says she needs to deal with it, but I think you need to be very careful that I'm honoring her as a weaker vessel, recognizing her desire to love and nurture and provide for my kids and develop a home of as a safe haven for ministry. That's hard to do in a one-bedroom apartment with five kids. I mean, we laugh, but we see it. I've seen it far too often.
Or the other side of that is we've seen, and I've seen, even around here at Southern Seminary, they go through this extreme sacrifice, you know, cram 3 years of an MDiv into five, and they're here, elongate their education pattern and program, and then they end up working in, you know, like a bookstore. And I'm going, you kidding me?
After graduation?
Yeah, and went out to L.A. would drive us bonkers because they'd moved to L.A., nothing's, you know, they live in the hood in Newhall. We call it Seminary Row. I mean, you bring your book bag and your gun
And you walk to the bus stop, literally, because you can't afford. I mean, that's how it was for us. And then you do all that hard work, all that heavy lifting, and then, you know, ministry is something like working at some, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You better be, I mean, if I'm the wife, I'd be saying, you better really take that
degree somewhere.
The practical
side of it is I mean, if you're already in that situation, man alive, I think that I would encourage you guys, you need to be working like crazy, but you still need to be a priest in your home. You need to be a protector of your wife. And I'm not just talking about physically shielding her from, you know, flying objects. I'm talking about protecting her heart, protecting her desire to support you in the ministry. I mean, I grew up in a pastor's home, and my mom was always my dad's biggest fan because my dad never made my mom the mercy killing of his ministry. And so, you know, he's been at the same church for 40 years, and that's not because everybody at the church has always loved my dad or her, but my mom loves it because he loves it. And so, you know, God is providential, and if there's anything that I have deeper conviction on now than I ever have, it's not only the sovereignty of God in salvation, but it's the sovereignty of God in his providential care of my daily minutia to the point of conception. And God doesn't call me to a life that's contrary to that which he's already blessed me with. Does that make sense? And so I think you really have to weigh that in the context of the calling on my life. That being said, I think that if the decision as a couple is to go ahead and pursue ministry, which is going to require education, then there needs to be a clear communication of my intention to work in that to relieve whatever financial pressure will occur as a result of that. Does that make sense? I just don't think it makes sense for guys that come and basically go to school full time. They're working the graveyard shift as security guards, and they got four kids running around with no clothes on. That to me does not reek of Christ. It's selfishness. But it can be done. It's just you got to be on the same page. And so, going back to the debt issue, to the degree that financing that education with taking what he said, with a very firm conviction and commitment to moving into ministry, we're not treading water here. We're not going to seminary because we frankly don't want to go into the real world, or we don't know what to do, so the spiritual thing to do means to go to school. But if we're really committed to taking this as a launching pad for very committed and direct ministry, then I think it makes a tremendous amount of sense, presuming that she's on the same page with that. But I think pulling somebody kicking and screaming into ministry and taking on a debt load of finances to get it done, it shouldn't be that difficult. I don't know if that answers the question, but
yeah, while I don't promote, you know, elongating your education and going taking a long time to get through the education and then end up going nowhere with the education, I also would promote simultaneously extending your education,
right,
intentionality, because you're trying to minister and care for your family. In other words, I may take 5 years. That's the plan going into it. It's not like I just kind of keep adjusting. I'm on the line every year. I look at it, you know, my class load, and I come on the line and I call an audible every year. Not, we're going to go 8 years now. And she's going, 8 years? Yeah. That's interesting. Okay, I'm going to follow you. I mean, there's a time where you say, okay, we're going to do this in 5 years. And you know what? That means I'm going to have to work hard. And I just had the philosophy going through seminary, I'm going to do whatever it takes. That meant, for me, that meant spending time, you know, with her from 5 to 7 or 8 or 9 o'clock at night. She goes to bed. She'd see me go to bed. She falls asleep. I get back up. And I work till 4 in the morning because I'm going to get it done. That's what, you know, that's what being a man is. That's what being a leader is. And that's what you do. So I'm not sacrificing all my time in my marriage on the altar of education. But I'm augmenting that and having a good, I think what you're saying, a good plan going in it, an agreed upon plan. And we're going to this field, if it's Russia or wherever it is. That's another thing. If you pile up a bunch of debt, it's going to hinder you in the ministry. It really is. I went to seminary and got out of debt because we got lean and mean. The best thing for you is to get lean and mean, because you can have a blast and grow together as a couple by walking in a park and it doesn't cost you a dollar. You got the nicest park system here in town. You can go for a nice walk and forge that relationship with your spouse. It doesn't cost you a whole lot of money. You don't have to do all these extra things. And that's what I love about seminary. And it's a faith enterprise. I mean, we're going to call everybody in our church to live by faith. Guess what? Seminary is where God says, guess what you're going to do? You're going to learn to live by faith. You're going to learn to live on very little in a very distressed time, because you've got to be put in that crucible so that you can appreciate it. So in the spirit of 2 Corinthians 1, you will then be able to minister to people in the future and know where they are and where they've been and where they're going and what the circumstances are. But I see a lot of guys just not willing to pay the price. It's heavy lifting in the ministry. And the easiest time you're going to have is while you're in seminary. When you get out in the field, it's going to get nasty. It's going to get really busy and really intense, and sheep bite and kick and fight and fuss. And, you know, there's all kinds of dimensions to the ministry. And it's not just a place to go and hang out and an easy career. That's not the gig's up. Let me tell you, that's not, you know, the gospel ministry. And you've seen it in your dad. Mm-hmm. You know, eavesdropping and all of that. I mean, it's tough. And so you have to, I think the big takeaway there is you sit down with your spouse and you work through a plan. You stick to that game plan, whatever that game plan is for you as a couple. Well, questions from you guys? We were up here just kind of talking, but any questions in particular you have that was generated by what Mark said, or you have about ministry or local church or the finances? Yes, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great comment, and I wish that, every family in the church heard what you guys just said. Every family in the seminary heard what you just said. But my wife and I are planning on returning to our home state, Massachusetts, starting a church. And, you know, do you have any resources in terms of an organization that I can contact to actually form, you know, a local church and the whole tax status and all of that? Do you have any recommendations on that?
In terms of establishing your nonprofit status?
That's right.
And all those things? Yep. Call Stewardship Services.
Okay, great.
Because at the very least, Jim's been doing this for 25, 30 years. He can point you in the right direction. Right.
And if you plant an SBC church, then you just go to the local association. They have all that stuff. Like, I've planted a church here in Louisville, and I've worked through our local association and the Southern Baptist Convention. They give you all the docs on that kind of stuff. They'll even sponsor you. You know, you're going to have to go through some form of assessment on that. But, you know, but just understand, I understand local church planting is very sexy right now, but it's extremely heavy lifting. That's why assessment predetermines if you're even able, because that means you're basically not going to have an income for 2 to 3 years, and you're going to go out and work as a barista, or you're going to work someplace where you can make a little bit of money because you want to be in community and living in community, and unless you just want to suck the life out of all the churches around you, you know, and have transfer growth. But if you want conversion growth, it means you're getting a job in that community. So you're basically going to be bivocational until that church matures enough financially, you know, to be able to carry you and to bring you on. So it's heavy lifting.
Did you use sexy and barista in the same sentence?
I think I did. It's just a... But it's very... Everyone wants to be a church planter.
Yeah.
They all think, you know, you go out and make 80 grand, sit around, you know, wear grungy T-shirts and jeans and contextualize and, you know, hang out. It's heavy lifting. It's knocking on doors. I mean, and it is absolutely depressing. You know, one Sunday I'm all rah-rah, the next time I'm like, poof. You know, Jeff's in the church. You know, I'm ready to shoot myself, you know. And it's a total different picture. I mean, I've been on a church staff. I ran a church staff of 240. I know what local church ministry is like. When it's big church, you just kind of making adjustments all the time. When you're out church planning, it's like you start from a blank sheet of paper on every single thing, you know. Insurances and board protection insurance. And there's all kinds of...
Yeah.
It's endless. So just make sure, if you want to be a church planner, it's just not some great vision, but you're willing to really pay the price. It's heavy, heavy lifting. It's a lot easier to be a local church pastor already established than it is to do that. So, questions? Jeffrey? Anybody? Question?
You mentioned finding a financial advisor, and where do we find one of those? Because when I think of that, finding an accountant or something, I generally think of spending money that a little bit too frugal to spend. How do we go about that?
I think one of the best ways is ask around. If you're a part of a church, ask around and interview. Sit down and interview several different options. And I think the other key is to find an advisor that charges a fee as opposed to a commission. I think you'll get a little bit more bang for your buck, if you will. But take the time to interview, and you'll find one.
Explain the industry so they understand fee and commission. They're going to be pushing product all the time.
I would say is a good financial advisor who's really got your interests in mind isn't going to be afraid to sit down with you for an hour without charging you. I mean, if a guy's going to invoice you for just you asking some basic questions, then he's not the right guy. I mean, that sounds a little bit oversimplistic, but the right guy shouldn't have a problem. Now, let me also caution this. This goes back to my earlier comments about soliciting the church. You can be a Christian and be a really incompetent financial advisor. And you can be a pagan and be a really good one. Ideally, you want to find a really good Christian one. But just because they got a Christian fish on their sign doesn't mean that they're technically proficient. Unfortunately, there's oftentimes an inverse correlation. But
the fish is always a no-no in any business.
Just be careful. You know, my lead blocker is not my salvation.
There's a lot of the self-investment things online, Ameritrade, Scottrade. Do you have any recommendations on what is the best bang for the buck? Some of these places do, cost per trade, fee per trade, or what have you.
Oh, you mean which brokerage is the best? That's a funny question, actually. We're just in the transition of changing our custodian, but, for the most part, they're all pretty competitive. I mean, it really just becomes down to choice, what you're trying to do. We recently have been doing some research and have feel like TD Ameritrade is putting together some nice programs. They tend to be pretty client-centric. Schwab historically has been a very good firm. We've done a lot of business. We do a lot of business, quite a bit of business with Schwab. Recently, we felt like their customer attention and service is waning. They've had some change in leadership. So that's kind of our personal bias. I would probably stay away from the really small ones. Some of the firms like a Scottrade or maybe even an E-Trade, but that are really designed more for the high volume guy that's trading a lot. Keep in mind, it's kind of like anything. The bigger your account, the lower your fees get. But I think TD Ameritrade, we're a little bit biased because we're transitioning to using them in our own business. But I've been encouraged and have been pretty impressed with their technology, the simplicity of their tools. So, for accumulation, it's hard to beat Vanguard because they're so cheap. That being said, the portability of Vanguard is terrible, and their customer service is pretty weak. That's why they're so cheap. So, ideally, I would probably try to identify somebody that could help you put together a plan, whether or not they're the ones that implement that plan, but even if it's just somebody that you know. Yeah.
Me and my wife are kind of in the second boat coming to seminary a little later. We've worked for about 10 years. And we have three 401ks. What do we do with those now? That's been our question. Like, we have three 401ks. I mean, they have a decent amount of money in them. But what should we combine? Can you combine them?
Are they all? Are they in your name only?
Two of them are in my name. One's in my wife's name.
They're still at the employer.
They're still with the employer. Yeah.
Yeah, consolidation. You're able to combine all three of those. Well, individually. So if you have two in your name, you can combine that into one. But consolidation is definitely an advantage. You don't have statements coming in from three or four different custodians.
You can roll it into an IRA, is what he's saying. You need to open up an IRA account. You are not subject to the limitations of funding. And so to continue with the thread that we said earlier, you could go to TD Ameritrade. You could request what's called a rollover kit. They're going to send you paperwork. You're going to open up two IRAs, one in your name, one in her name. You fill out the forms. You'll have to contact your former HR people, and you'll probably, not knowing what firm they were with, but you'll probably end up just liquidating, and that money will roll. Now, it's very important when you do a rollover IRA to actually roll the money from your 401k directly to the IRA. Do not send a check. They'll ask you, do not, because you are potentially putting yourself at risk of having to pay the penalties for withdrawals and so forth. So if you just go online, if you go to any of them, Fidelity, TD Ameritrade, Schwab, Scott Trade, E-Trade, and just request an IRA rollover kit. And then you're going to have an IRA for you, an IRA for her. Submit the paperwork, and then it'll all just transfer over, and then you can basically reinvest it however you want.
That's exactly what I did.
But you should absolutely do that, because I can tell you right now, the fees you're paying that you don't know you're paying in your old 401k are exorbitantly high.
Okay, yeah.
Because they're an accumulation vehicle. They're not an investment vehicle. That's the primary design of a 401k is how to accumulate with small additions.
Okay. And then I got one other question. This is kind of an odd question, but we made some money on our house that we just recently sold. What's your how do you go about tithing with that?
That's a great question. Where'd you sell it?
Salt Lake City.
Okay, so from the Utah area.
Yeah.
How long did you own it?
5 years.
So it's non-taxable.
Yeah.
Right. It's all your money. You don't owe any tax on that. You knew that, right?
Yeah, but we part of my question is we put a lot of money into the house, and that's why it is what it is. So I'm just trying to figure out where's the morally responsible.
Well, I think everybody's got their personal convictions, but there's a portion of those proceeds that if it wasn't the way the tax code was written, if it was the old days and you had to reinvest the money and you didn't, what percentage of that money would be taxable? I mean, I don't think there's any straight answer to look at that. I think that really comes from the heart, and it really is, I guess the question is how much can I give? Yeah. And what's the most I could give and still be a good steward and a responsible husband and father?
I would start with the life plan at seminary, or your seminary plan, your life plan, and let your conscience. I mean, that's one of those 2 Corinthians 8. We want to, if it's in our heart to give cheerfully, what is that? You know, and you guys sit down and go to coffee and say, you know, and make it a true joy of giving. If you want to give, then, I mean, bless some other students, bless the mission, whatever you want to do. I don't think you're bound by anything.
We get a little bit of the same question. You know, if we've got people, we've got clients that have large sums of money and they have taxable income, but they're generating sometimes, you know, 6 figures in profits in their investment account, you know, is that tithable assets? And our response typically is, you've been blessed with a resource of money that, quite honestly, if it wasn't for the Lord, you wouldn't have it in the first place, going back to my earlier comments about who's the giver of it. So really, it's all His. The question is, how much can I give of that and still be considered a wise steward? You know, which part of that is digging in a hole and putting in it? Which of it is investing in creating opportunity greater? You know, so I think you take some of those basic biblical principles, you say, hey, I'm going to be in school. Does it make sense for me to invest that money? It might. I don't know your situation. And so do I want to invest some of that in the kingdom? Do I want to invest some of that in the stock market? Do I want to invest, you know what I mean? In those lines. But I don't think there's any hard and fast rule that says, absolutely, you need to tithe on that.
One thing on the end of the tax, your 403B, you know, like here at seminary, I think we offer two plans, right? TIA, Craft, Edward, and Guidestone. The reason why, even at Grace Church, we went with Guidestone. When Guidestone opened up outside of the Southern Baptist Convention, they gave us the opportunity. We went there is because when you take a housing allowance, once you retire as a pastor, then you can, that money, that retirement account, you can take a housing allowance against it, whereas TIA Craft, you cannot. So you're going to be taxed on that. So that's a huge benefit. So if you only need, you know, $30,000 to live on, and you're going to still be having housing issues, and where you're coming off the mission field, you're going to have to buy a house because you didn't have, you know, there's all these factors in the ministry. But that's one of the reasons why you ought to stay, if you can, with a Guidestone-like product and 403B. And they'll come into your church, too, so you can bring it to your leadership and say, hey, can we have this? You know, we may have, we had T.A. Kreft forever at Grace, and then we brought in Guidestone and added that layer to Guidestone.
That's a clergy 403B, which is specifically designed. There's secular, which would be for schools, but they don't have the housing on it.
Right. Yeah, clergy.
You know, I was just thinking about your question. I know one situation I had a conversation with a guy. What he did was he took the proceeds, he invested them, and then he committed the tithing from his profit and or loss from that. So obviously he became very conservative because he was going to have to give money, but he decided to invest it and out of the proceeds of that tithe. So it just depends.
Questions over here? Go ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned this about attitudes and presuppositions towards money itself and not being ascetic but also not being materialistic. I was wondering if any of you could just address that more about how you approach your standard of living, possessions, and the quality of the possessions, things like that. Because, I mean, we live obviously in a very materialistic culture. Things are status symbols, and while not seeking to do that, but, you know, if you're buying things that break down all the time, you're maybe not being a wise steward of your money. So just thoughts on that?
Well, I'd add another resource written by the same individual. You have Randy Alcorn's book there, but there's a second one called The Treasure Principle. Yeah. That goes right after the standard of living question. It's a small kind of what I call gift book size, you know, that has enough substance but doesn't cost you an arm and a leg, and kind of a bridge. And he's reduced it down to have you guys seen The Treasure Principle before? That's a tremendous book because he even asked the hard question. In other words, if God increases your salary, is he saying, I'm also increasing your standard of living? Or is God saying, I'm not increasing your standard of living, I'm increasing your standard of giving? See what I'm saying? That's the question we have in the ministry. So when you get a raise and the leadership comes back to you and says, as a pastor, we love what you're doing, we want to bless you, do you immediately then go out and buy a boat or a bigger car? I mean, that's just something I think all of us have to answer on a annual basis, or if not monthly, even daily at times. You know, as God blesses you and prospers you, whatever that might be percentage-wise, that's the first question that I want to ask myself. Do I need to change my standard of living or live well within my means? And you can develop philosophies. You may say, Mark says the average person sends 30 to 38% of their income on their housing. You know, well, you can do less and have more money for giving. I mean, it's just, you can adjust those ratios. And so it becomes a bit of a philosophy, you know.
You know, one of the other things, though, I think in a very practical way is aggressively. And I know I went through this, and we make a big deal about this with Cornerstone, which is our fellowship group back in L.A., is really training my mind to be totally neutral at my perception of other people's wealth. Because what it does is it helps me in my own heart. In other words, it was almost like I forced my eyes to not allow myself to place any judgment, particularly amongst fellow believers, okay, is I actually determined in my own heart, I saw it as sin, that whatever thought came to my mind when I saw whatever physical accoutrements, whether it was, you know, we joke about it, but it's like, we joke about it, because like, the high-end Ford is okay, but the low-end Lincoln Continental is not, you know, the you know what I mean, the 5 series BMW is a nice car, but the 7 is a little bit overboard, you know, and we have these structures, what I call these spiritual constructs in our mind that we all have, that we've somehow said that's okay but that's not, you know. I'll never forget, I had a conversation with a guy, and he just thought no Christian should live in a house over 4,000 square feet. But 3,800 was totally fine to him. And I said, while I don't discount the reality of what you're trying to accomplish in terms of your thinking, it's totally faulty at its core. And so I think it really starts with determining in your mind, you know, It's all those things you read in Scripture about. He would not let his eyes look upon that woman, I would not pray to that object. Is you determine in your mind, I will not allow my mind to place any kind of judgmental perception on my recognition of people's wealth. And then I will develop an appreciation and thankfulness that God's blessed them with it. Then, once I've developed those personal convictions, I do have to then recognize that I don't want to cause another brother to stumble, recognizing that most people around me don't have that same view. And that I could very well be causing someone to stumble as a result of what I'm okay with. So you do have to be pragmatic enough to know, not that you're being duplicit, but you can't ramrod your Christian liberties, down the throat of the weaker brother. So, let's face it, as believers, we live in a body of believers, of extremely sinful people, and I'm a sinner, and so that's why we have to be so vigilant with renewing our mind and developing that strict consciousness. But I think rather than saying, well, then how do I develop what's okay, I think what it really comes down to is driving back into my heart an unwillingness to allow myself to be that way towards others. And over time, I will develop a pattern that I think becomes okay. Does that make sense? In other words, instead of trying to figure out what's the spectrum of okayness in my people, what I need to do is I need to be broadening my personal spectrum. Because what will happen is that will drive my heart more in tune with seeing the heart of people. And then I'll begin to see my own heart. Does that make sense? And I just think it becomes less of an issue. I don't get bogged down with trying to figure out how much is too much and how little is too little. I'm set free in a lot of ways to just minister to people and to continually develop my love for people.
I think in the ministry too, I think James 2 informs a lot of that, that you have the potential of showing deference to a wealthy person in the church because they look wealthy. And a lot of times guys that dress the part, and that's what they did in James' account, they'd go out and buy rings, the gold-ringed man. They were just purchased in those. It was a game. It was a shell. They weren't really that wealthy. But then the church assembly there in James 2, they would actually treat them different. You come over and sit here. You come over and sit here. So you had this whole favoritism issue that has to inform us as pastors, because we're going to talk to people, have lunch with people, minister to people, and you just cannot assess them on the outside. And you have to be super careful of that. And you have to, you have to look at the heart. And the body's made up of all types of people. And so you just have to be really cautious that you don't fall into a combination of James 2 where you begin to show favoritism to this segment of the congregation. God, your congregation's going to look a lot like heaven's going to look, and there's going to be all different, variety of people. The other thing is materialism, it promotes, pride. We know that. It often is accompanied with pride, but so is asceticism. It's still the same form of pride. The guys that take pride, and I'm going to walk to my congregation, I'm going to live in the hood, and I'm, and it becomes a form of pride as well. And I think that's what you're getting at. Just don't allow yourself to go there in your mind. Preach the gospel to yourself in this area, in this segment of the gospel as well, with finances, all the time to yourself. And don't look at people like that. Look at them as a part of the body of Christ. So those are just a couple of things. I mean, I think guys get on the other end of this perspective on asceticism. They just that's their form of pride. Look how broke I can be, and that's it's like the guy fasting in the Sermon on the Mount. Woe is me, and throwing up ashes, and it's a shell game. A good little fun read. Fall reading days are coming up, and so it's fun read, right? The Millionaire Next Door. Have you ever read that? The book, small paperback. You can pick it up.
It's a great book.
Millionaire Next Door, and it's basically saying there's tons of people all around you that are millionaires. They just are never going to show you that. They're not going to flaunt that. They've got a perspective. They've got not even a biblical perspective. What's the number one car for millionaires? What is it?
F-150.
Ford F-150. That's all, this book does all the stats
so
and all the
data. If you've got one, don't be prideful.
Yeah, if you got one, you need to get rid of it. No.
You've been
from Arkansas. Everybody had one.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole point. They're, you know, it's a shell game. If a lot of guys with all the flash and glitz, and you know, you look at them and you go, they're like you guys. I mean, in Los Angeles, we knew they were leveraged. You know, they're driving a Hummer, two Hummers. You know, and we're going, there's no way. I know what that guy makes roughly. So he's daddy's really wealthy and he's from Texas and had a bunch of oil, or he's leveraged. You know, and that's, you know what I'm saying? That's not something where you want to pursue that. And now they were banking on the economy. It crashes, and guess what? They're exposed.
Not driving it anymore.
They're not driving it anymore. They're getting it picked up. That's why, you know, Repo is like the number one show now all of a sudden on the Spike Channel. That's all you see on now these days is the Repo shows. So Repo business is a good business to bank in right now. That's probably the best business to be in right now.
While you're talking about vehicles, I was just wondering, once you get a vehicle paid off, at what point should you drop full coverage insurance and save a few $100 every 6 months as opposed to going to liability insurance? Does that question make sense? You're all looking at me.
Yeah.
Can you drop liability altogether?
You cannot.
Drop liability. Okay. Yeah. So, on your side of the equation, right?
When it's a piece of junk.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, I think it's, well, no. I mean, I think there's still a stewardship issue. I mean, it doesn't make sense It depends on what. I guess it's just the cost analysis. And in the end, I mean, you're just going to have to do a cost analysis, and there's no right or wrong answer. The question is just how much do you like having to pull out and write a check for something that you could have not had to do if you paid $20 a month for? I mean, it really, I think, is a personal preference issue when it comes down to it. What makes sense, you know? I mean, I think it makes the most sense is to if you can do it, is to buy a car and drive it till the wheels fall off in terms of a cost basis. I mean, there's different breakpoints with a car, but basically, I think it makes sense if the car is working and functional and it can keep you safe, and you can have some insurance on it, you know, have it. You know, if it's worth $1,000 or less, I probably wouldn't do it. So,
Mark, address the issue. I just forgot my thought. Go ahead. Totally.
I'll
forgot.
Address that issue.
Yeah, address that issue. The big one that's looming out there.
Thoughts?
Yeah, forgetting your thought. You had that once earlier today.
Right.
Questions? I'll think of it in a second. To some degree, yeah.
Oh, you mean the coverage, not the liability, but the personal coverage.
Right.
Collision.
Yeah.
That's what you want to
pack. Yeah. I'd probably put that plus maybe $1,000, you know, just for the hassle, because, you know, there's always the difference between the bid and ask, but yeah.
Car's never investment.
No.
Always a liability. Where did we get the idea, Mark and or Bobby, that a house was an investment? Do you think it's an investment? Or is it just a place you're going to live in? I mean, you know what I'm saying? In California,
be,
we bought it as an investment.
It might be, but you won't know until you sell it.
Right. But you don't buy a house based on, you know,
no.
You're trying to find a place to live. I think that's what happened in California. Everybody began to think real estate was an actual investment.
Your personal residence is not an investment, and your personal residence should not be the key to your retirement.
Right.
Because your personal residence is your personal residence. Your intention should be to buy it and own it and live in it.
And not owe anything at retirement. That's significant too.
If you want to make an investment in real estate and you want to buy an investment property as a rental property, that's a different issue.
Mm-hmm.
But stretching my personal lifestyle to justify my purchase as an investment is a massive mistake, and one that I personally know too many people in California in particular that are reeling from this market. Got to keep in mind, this housing market could stay down for another 5 to 8 to 10 years. I mean, last time we saw this happen, people sat on houses for 10 years and didn't make a dime. So it's a it's an unfortunate situation. Can I say something? I thought of this because this is an issue where we are, and I don't know that it's an issue here, but if you're in this boat, let me just speak to you for a second. Choosing to foreclose on a home simply because you don't like the fact that it's worth less than what you owe is not consistent with a Christian's view of contract. I've had too many people come to me recently and said, my house isn't worth what I owe. My credit's already bad. I'm just going to walk away. I said, well, you got a job. Can you afford the payment? Yeah, but it's, you know, you got to understand. I mean, you got to understand, there's people in California whose house is worth $300,000-$500,000 less than they owe, which is kind of a bizarre thought for a lot of people in the Midwest, but it's true. But you're contractually obligated to make that payment because you said you would. It's not like if I can't make the payment or I don't feel like making the payment, I won't make it. Now, if you can't make it, then that's a different situation. But I don't think it's one of those. I have a hard time with people that are saying, I don't feel like keeping the house, so I'm just going to walk away from it, when they could very well just keep paying it.
Psalm 15 says what? We swear to our own hurt. You make a commitment, you keep your commitments. You know, we swear
to our own
hurt.
You won't do that again. Even though that we will, because but.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any books or websites or resources for, you know, people who come up and ask you, you know, for just basic financial information, like they don't know the difference between a Roth IRA and a stock, just where their, you know, mom and dad just didn't teach them that, or they're just coming out of college or high school into the work environment, and just some basic information, whether it's Christian or secular, that kind of explains these things we've talked about today.
There's plenty of information on the internet, so you can go to custodians like Fidelity and Charles Schwab and pull down just basic investment information, which is helpful for terms. When it enters into the Christian decision process and convictions, that type of thing, there's some good resources. Crown Ministries is great.
She totally drives me crazy, but Susie Orman is got some good information. I think she's totally obnoxious to listen to and watch, but maybe it's because she does speak so simply that that it's a little bit like scratching a chalkboard. But I mean, she speaks to the very, very bottom line, you know, financial issues. You know, there's the Motley Fool. They've got some good information.
You got to understand, so I'll speak as a layman. Versus they have a whole language grid that they work in, and it's designed a little bit for job security. That you can't go. I mean, it is like legalese sometimes. And so, when I came to Southern, all of a sudden they threw a $76 million endowment at my feet. Said, "Okay, you're managing this now. That's management." I'm like, "Wow, I've never done that. That's fun." I mean, I see my little account, and then I see $76 million in the seminary's account because we're all both on the Schwab platform. So. And so, you know, I had to learn, and I've been for 2 years working hard at, I mean, weekly working hard at it. And I still, you know, they'll throw standard deviations at you, risk, I mean, volatility. They'll build these charts, and you're just almost paralyzed. So everybody just sits around the room agreeing with them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I got it. So there's a little bit of that. I mean, you
totally.
Got to be honest.
No, there
I mean,
is.
That's the way it is. So that's, I mean, it forces you to kind of go to and that's why you want to go to your leadership, spiritual leadership. Who's the best advisor in the church? Who can help me with this? I often find myself going out to these type of websites or Wikipedia, believe it or not, and kind of Googling something. Or you can Google if it's a philosophy. You know, we were considering at one time, which would have been a colossal mistake for the seminary, to go to Portable Alpha, which is where your Yale endowments are, which are getting slaughtered in New York Times this week. But, you know, we were looking at it, so I'm just trying to find, I'm just reading a lot about it, reading Money Magazine, you know, there's different magazines. I pick them up every once in a while and just try to garner information, but that's, you just kind of dabble in it a little bit. And oftentimes it's not on your radar yet until it's thrown on your radar. Either, you know, your you know, father-in-law dies in our situation, or, you know, something happens, and all of a sudden you're dropped in a bucket of money. You're like, oh, what do I do with this, you know? And so any other resources you like?
Yeah, no, I think among the periodicals, I think Kiplinger's is one of the better magazines. Money Magazine is entertaining, but I just think that there's too much bias there on their advertisers. I think Kiplinger's is a pretty fair educational approach versus a entertainment approach that I think Money Magazine has. That's my personal bias. But, I mean, I don't get either of them, but when I'm in the airport and I'm walking through and I want, if I've got some reading or something, I think Kiplinger's, it's owned by Wall Street Journal, but I think it's one of the better ones out there. Yeah.
I have a few short questions. The first shortest one, Quicken, does it automatically retrieve your information if you, you know, give it your account stuff?
Yeah, what happens is with Quicken is you're gonna put in your vendor, so if it's the bank or if it's the credit card company, and they have most of them pre-built into the system. So yeah, once you basically put your information in there, it'll go if you're on an internet connection, it'll just go get the information and upload it in.
Especially, that's you're going to use something of that basis that you talked about. You're going to get Quicken. They have all the drop-down bars. Right. And it's
QuickBooks or something.
QuickBooks or, yeah, that's what.
But it's pretty amazing. It is pretty amazing because you haven't been on it. You're like, really? Yeah.
Back to the question about credit cards. My wife and I, the reason we wanted to get a credit card, we're both frugal, don't have any debt.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of thinking it might help with budget, getting the thing at the end of the month, and it might help with security as far as buying online. So first, was that a right line of thought? Should we get a credit card? And then B, like we tried getting like a kind of a nice credit card at first, which it just, you know, that was pointless. But then I actually went through our bank, mm-hmm. and it didn't even work there. They, you know, rejected us, so.
Well, one of your problems is like the guy that tries to get a job, and everywhere he goes, he says they need experience first. It's also why we encourage people with kids to try to get your kid a credit card at a fairly young age, because you want to build up credit. It's unfortunate, but we live in a credit-dependent culture, and so your frugality has created your own problem, and that is you don't have a credit score. You know, and so now that you need credit, they're not really sure what to go by. So if your bank won't give you a credit card, I would probably contact, there's a great website called Bankrate, Bankrate, bankrate.com, which will show you the best credit cards rates available today all over the country, because you can get a credit card with basically anybody in the country. For years, there was a bank out of Arkansas that used to issue a credit card that was like 6% interest, and they don't do it anymore, but I think Simmons National or something. But I would go there, and before you apply, I would actually contact them, let them know your kind of your situation, and just see, is it worth me even trying, so they don't have to go through that mess.
Can you use a cosigner?
The second thing I would do is if you're having those problems, do you guys have credit unions? Here?
Do
you have credit unions?
Yeah.
I would try to go to a credit union. Credit unions tend to be a little bit more people-friendly versus company-friendly. So if you go to a credit union, and I'm almost positive Southern probably has some affiliation with a credit union in town.
I don't think so.
Well, credit unions determine if you
I
do.
I hope I'd know.
You don't have to go to them. So that they want you to come to them. Credit union is just basically like a co-op type bank.
Right.
So I would do a search for credit unions in the area, and I would go to a visit one in person. They actually believe in a handshake still. So
you could also do, you can do a co-sign, can't you, with your family? If your family would say, okay, give me, you can co-sign on a credit card. They use them as the back, the collateral, kind of speak, so to speak. And then as soon
Dan
as you get a
co-sign with one.
I'd do a few for you, but. For 20% return, no. But anyway, I think there's a scripture about that. But I think what you end up doing is, and then what'll happen is once you get one, then you'll start getting requests, you know, sent to you, and then you just drop off the cosign. You know, you could do that as a possibility. I don't know. You have any ideas? Oh, you have an idea? Okay.
We were looking for a home loan. We talked to the credit telco, and there's another one. I think it's called
way where you give them so much of your savings and then you take a loan out against your own savings? I'm not sure how it works.
Yeah, it's called a collateralized loan. That's one of the ways they can do it. Yeah, all they're looking for is a credit history. They're trying to just see if you have a pattern of paying it off. It might take 6 months, 8 months, but...
You can do that at a lot of your banks, at your own bank where you're banking, you can do the same thing.
Yeah, so you can actually pay them to use your own money. It's really a neat process they have. Yeah.
But, when you go to credit unions, do be very careful and look at their structure of fees. It's a little different than what it is at a bank, and they charge for everything. You need to be very, very careful.
Depends on the credit union, I guess.
Yeah, what you're choosing in there, because you can wind up paying $20, $30, $40 a month.
Wow.
There is another way that is those debit cards. Mm-hmm. That you see, and you can set it up as a credit card too. And usually those places, you go in and you like it, Walgreens or something, and get that and get it set up through their I think it's a Columbia Bank in Georgia.
Huh.
Green Dot. If you do it through that, then you kind of establish a credit history, and then you start getting these.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's 2:00, and I want to respect you guys' time, and I wanted to thank Mark, Bobby, for coming out from California to help us and to shepherd us and to think through these issues. We'll be here afterwards for a few minutes, I'm sure. And if you have personal questions, I'm here all the time. You can always feel free to stop by if you're needing some help, some guidance. We'll find somebody. If I can't answer your question, We'll put you with somebody to help you. We do not want you to come to Southern Seminary and have a great theological education, and it undermines, you know, your marriage and brings conflict there. We really are genuinely concerned that all of that lines up well, that you have a healthy marriage, a healthy experience here at Southern Seminary. So this is why we'll do these kind of events for you. And I hope you enjoyed it. I hope... You got a lot out of it. I hope you'll take the notebook and use it and integrate it into your family plan and your seminary plan. But I want to thank you for being here, giving up your Saturday. But I do want to honor your time.
And I'm happy if you want to contact us. I don't. You're more than welcome to call us, and I'd be happy to chat with you. So you're welcome to do that. I don't have any of our information, but Dan has it, or you can go to our website and get our phone number. It's criterionwealth.com. Is our website. So if you have any questions specific to a situation, I'm more than happy to chat with you.
Thank you. Enjoy your
Thank you.
Saturday afternoon.